Medicaid planning, elder care and health law, criminal defense, not-for-profit and entity formation, commercial financing. O'Connell and Aronowitz, attorneys at law, 518-462-5601. 518-462-5601. OALaw.com.
Hi, this is Arnie Schwartz, host of Talk of the Town. Alternate Tuesday evenings from 6 to 7 on WIOX, Roxbury. Serving New York's Catskill region at 91.3 FM, WIOXradio.org, and MTC Cable, Channel 20.
WIOX is supported by the Sam's and Fleischmann's, Sam's Country Store Deli and Gas Station. Open every day for groceries, Mexican herbs, local craft beer, and with food to go, sandwiches, tortas, and tacos, and on weekends, tamales. Sam's on Main Street in Fleischmann's. Sam's Country Store, NY.com. Kriya, a store designed as a source for sustainable artisanal products, including Kriya's own jewelry made from reclaimed metals and ethically produced goods to wear and share. Kriya, K-R-I-A, on Main Street in Margaretville. More information at KriyaJewelry.com. Hannah Mountain Resort and Country Club with 29 guest rooms, restaurant, and bar, specializing in wedding packages, including rehearsal, dinner, ceremony, reception, farewell brunch, and accommodations for guests. And golf memberships are available for Hannah's 18-hole championship golf course. Information at HannahCountryResort.com or 845-586-4849.
Hi, this is Andy Cahill, host of the Andy Cahill Show on WIOX Roxbury. If you listen to my program, you know how passionate I am about music and community radio. What you may not know is that I'm just as passionate about community solar energy. Delaware River Solar is a community solar company set up to provide an easy and accessible way to begin participating in renewable energy, and it doesn't involve installation of solar panels. It's designed to be efficient and clean and keep tons of carbon emissions out of the air. Delaware River Solar, a supporter of WIOX, is a solar energy company for Catskills region communities. And when it comes to community, well, you can count me in. I'd be happy to share the details about Delaware River Solar at 845-586-2058 or andy.cahill@delawareriversolar.com.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi on smart devices through the Radio FM app, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talking about a different force-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight, but tonight we have a guest on, and tonight's topic is going to be Healthy Trees with Vern Rist. He is the owner of Healthy Trees Consultation and Services. He has a B.S. in Forest Biology from SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, 1976, an M.S., in plant, I don't want to date you here, Vern, but
that's all right.
An MS in plant pathology and air pollution from Penn State, 1978, PhD in plant pathology, Cornell University, 1981, and he moved to Saugerties in 1986 after visiting Woodstock in the southeastern Catskill Mountains while completing his PhD. And so what made you move to the Catskills?
Well, first time traveling down through to visit some friends, stopped in Phoenicia on the way from Ithaca, and I got out of the car, and I just instantly fell in love with the feeling of the place, the smell of the air and all that. My family's from the Adirondacks, and it felt very Adirondacky, and I can remember my first thought was, you know, I would like to live here someday, and it took a few years, but I did end up taking a chance and just moving here on a hope and a prayer.
Yeah, you never know when you might run into home sometimes.
It was like running into home, and now, all these years later, it's definitely become home.
I grew up in New Paltz in the Wallkill Valley, but I'll just keep it real short because this is about you. But I remember the first time I went to the Rondout Valley, I felt that way.
Yeah.
And I just like the Rondout Valley. I don't know why. I can't really tell you exactly why.
But it's got the right vibe for you.
Yeah, who knows why, you know? But yeah, so did I get that right? Is it Healthy Trees or Healthy Plants?
It was originally Healthy Plants, but then I reorganized 10 or so years ago and got totally legitimate, totally on the books and all that, and my lawyer suggested I change the name. And so since we do mostly tree work, I changed it to Healthy Trees.
And what got you into this plants and trees and whatnot?
Well, totally into nature as a child, going fishing with my dad and being initially starting out in the Adirondacks. I just was outdoors all the time, and I loved plants and trees, and I had a natural love of them. And then in my around 10, the Dutch elm disease came through and took out the huge elm trees on my street, and our home base for hide-and-go-seek was the big elm right in front of my house.
Yeah.
And it just hurt. And I got into the thought of plant diseases at that time, and then one thing led to another, and here I am 60 years later.
And someone from the Adirondacks in upstate New York, I guess the Finger Lakes as well, you said?
Yes, we moved to the Finger Lakes outside of Syracuse in a little town called Marcellus, which is kind of a one-horse town in the middle of nowhere, but so I grew up from the time I was 6 in the Finger Lakes. It's beautiful country, but this is home now.
Yeah, we don't get a northern perspective too often. So how would you compare and contrast that area to the Catskill Mountains?
Well, very different environmentally. It's much more open, and the Finger Lakes are really awesome. There's a little more big bodies of water and streams there, believe it or not. The winters are more severe. In the Adirondacks, of course, the winters are much more severe. When I first moved here as an avid skier back in the early 80s and skiing at Hunter Mountain, and the sky was blue and the sun was out, and I said, this isn't winter. But now that I'm getting older, the winters are starting to feel like winters here after all.
Right. Last year was, a real winter, right?
It was a pretty real winter last year for a change, yeah. It stayed pretty cool consistently.
The year before that was 36 degrees every day, to let you know. Because I got my truck that year, and I thought the thermometer was broken.
Right. I find that depressing. I want winter to be winter. I want it at least to be below freezing most of the days.
Right. So
we can talk about that in terms of trees and what that's doing as the winter's warm, but we can get into that as we go along.
How would you compare the forest and trees in the Adirondacks the most? How do they differ to the Catskills?
Well, that's interesting. There's common species, the white pines and the hemlocks and the ash trees that are very common here are also very common there. There's a lot more oaks here. There are more of a southern species. I mean, there certainly are oaks up in the Adirondacks, but not nearly so predominant as there are around here. Also, the birches, although common here, they're very common there. And things like yellow birch, which like higher altitudes, are really common there. When we see them here, and they're one of my favorite trees, they're so beautiful. But there's a lot more yellow birch up there.
Yeah.
And there used to be a lot of beeches. They got wiped out a lot by the beech bark disease, which is around here too, but it hasn't ravaged quite as badly as it did up there for some reason. Anyway, so there's distinct differences. But the hemlocks and the white pines are clearly both here and there in a big way.
Yeah, hemlock's a special tree in the Catskills, both heritage and just, to me, a sentimental tree.
Well, if I'm honest, I have to say hemlocks are my favorite trees. They're just so beautiful, and in the winter especially, they hold the snow so delightfully, and the birds love hiding out in there, and the color, that rich, deep green color in the middle of the winter is nice to have around.
We've had a show on this, John and I talking about our four favorite trees, but so hemlock is one of your favorite trees.
Yeah.
What others come to mind?
Well, I'm a tree hugger. What can I say? I love every species of tree. Even ailanthus has its good points.
Right.
But, you know, along with the hemlocks, probably next is a good, healthy, big, solid-trunked specimen sugar maple.
Yeah.
They are an iconic tree, both because I love maple syrup, but just the beauty of them and the fact that they have the potential to live for centuries kind of turns me on. Then white oak is another really grand species that I love a lot. But I can go right down the list, all the way down to something like striped maple, which most people don't even think about as being a tree, but it's an understory tree with really cool features. And I love pointing that out. I just did a nature tree walk at the Mountaintop Arboretum yesterday, and we spent a lot of time talking with the Elster Garden Club folks about the striped maple. And I could see them paying attention and being intrigued by looking at something a little different.
Yeah. Well, we got 2.5 out of 4. I was there.
Yeah, what are your favorites?
Uh-huh. Sugar maple, hemlock, red oak. That's why I say 2.5.
Yeah.
And you know why I like that tree now? Just because getting into tree climbing in the last 8 years.
Good for
such
you.
Such an easy tree. Easier. To put your line in.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying?
I do. and don't get me wrong. I love the red oaks. They have a certain bark appearance that I love to point out on tree identification that you can't miss once you get it down.
Yeah.
And they're a grand tree, no doubt.
An apple. You know, the freaking apples. You know, in the Catskill Mountains, it's amazing how many wild apple trees we have.
And you can really see it this year. It's a wonderful, wonderful apple year. And drive around, and you just see these apple trees that haven't been looked at or touched in decades, and they're just loaded with relatively blemished-free apples.
Some of the best apples are just ones growing on the side of the road.
Without being too offensive, I stop and munch them whenever I can if I'm not obviously trespassing on somebody's yard. And I love to make sweet cider, so I love to get as many bushel baskets of wild apples as I can to squeeze it up.
I've gotten better, but I used to be morally relaxed when it came to taking fruit.
Well, I understand.
Now
I wasn't going to be quite as honest as you're being.
It's pretty bad sometimes. But I've gotten better. But they're amazing. And sometimes you even find a wild apple tree that, just by sheer luck, has awesome form. Even you know, and you're like, geez, no one's even pruned that damn tree.
It's true, and that. Yeah, that could lead us into pruning. It's true, and you don't know whether that was a cultivar that was planted many, many years ago on some old farm that you can hardly see any evidence of anymore, except for some scattered apple trees, or whether that tree just happened to pop up on a seed that a bird dropped. Mm. There's so many cultivars and varieties of apples. I'd love to know all the ones that I see, whether they were man-bred or whether they're naturally occurring. But figuring all that out takes genetic analysis.
Do you know the difference between some apples, like they seem to fruit on spurs?
Yeah.
What's the deal with that?
Well, there's two different kinds. The spur apples tend to grow on little short spurs, and then there's another kind of apples. It's not that easy to tell them apart, to be honest with you, and I usually don't even bother trying to explain it. And it's not that important, really.
It's not that important. Okay, good. Because once in a while, someone will ask them, like, you know, I'm not really sure why they grow like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, there are distinct differences.
Yeah.
I have one spur apple that I love a lot, which McCune, which is a great eating fruit tree. I have 9 different cultivars of apple trees. And the macoons, one of my favorite to eat. The squirrels took every one but 3 of my good crop this year, so I had to break down and find some squirrel repellent, some organic thing called squirrel mace. It actually works, but it was a little too late by the time I started using it.
I try to grow apples. I got some clay soil and poorly drained, and over the years I've found the drier sites and retransplanted, but it is a chore, man.
It's a chore.
Growing apples is not for the faint of heart.
I on my website, I brag it up as a great thing to do, but then when it comes down to push and shove, I always warn people that it's a great idea to have a backyard, little mini orchard, but depending on how much you're willing to put into it, you got to prepare yourself that it isn't instant, wonderful, glorious crops every year.
How long do you think for the homeowner who wants to put an orchard it takes to get to fruition?
Well, that's a good point. Nowadays, we're planting much more of what are called semi-dwarf trees, which don't need to be supported. Actual dwarf trees need to be supported, and there's reason why there are dwarf trees. But the backyard person now would best be planting semi-dwarf trees.
Yeah.
And if you get a 3-year-old whip, which is just a little shoot that you can buy online or through the mail, those should be starting to produce, if you take care of them, in about 3 years, which isn't so bad. Whereas if you start planting standard trees, which are full-grown, big trees that haven't been put on any kind of a dwarfing rootstock,
right,
which is what all the old orchards used to be, well, those can be 10 to 15 years before they start producing.
Why is that? Do they grow? Because I have some standards I got from St. Lawrence right before they went out of business.
Yeah.
Now they're under new management or something. And I have some semi-dwarfs. And it's just like you said, about 3-4 years. Again, I got a poor sight. They're producing, yeah. Okay? But the standards, man, they are slow growing at first. In fact, some of those semi-dwarfs have caught up to them. Some of it is planter error. I've learned a lot. And you can read a lot in books, but after
experience
you do it, you're
like, experience is the best teacher. You know that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not sure why the bigger trees just are vegetative longer, and the semi-dwarfs and the dwarfs are all put onto rootstocks, which slow them down, and it allows them to get into a reproductive mode faster. I mean, that's kind of overly simplistically put.
Yeah.
But the whole movement away from those big trees from a commercial apple production standpoint is that it's just so expensive to prune and harvest from the big apple trees, that they've gone through great academic energy to develop systems where you have much smaller trees, which you can just go down and take care of much, much easier.
Less pruning, 3-foot spacing.
All of that
bud
stuff.
Bud nines.
Right, bud nines.
You know, I can't grow that in my soil. Those dwarfing are not tough. And
you don't want to be putting them in wet soils or thin soils. They're... Apples are pretty finicky about soils. I mean, you see them out in these old fields. Well, those old fields have got great soil, and they haven't been bothered in a long time.
Yeah.
Definitely don't want wet soil.
Pears seem to tolerate it better.
Pears are a little tougher and more tolerant and a little more productive consistently on their own than apples tend to be. I'm talking about not intensely cultivated apples or pears, you know, like backyard apples.
Yeah. So let's talk about areas you serve, and then we can get into some of the services you do. Like one of which is it seems to be heirloom apple orchards, right?
Well, the areas we serve, I like to stay. We're out of West Saugerties. I like to stay within a 30-mile radius from home. The closer to home, as I'm getting older, the better. But we do come out as far as Margaretville, which is about an hour drive, for certain services like taking care of sick hemlocks or ash trees. We can travel out here. I'm not going to haul out our lifts and chippers and all that to do heavy tree work. There's good folks out in this part of the woods that can do that, and I don't want to drive all the way out here with equipment. So a 30-mile radius. I tend not to go across the Hudson into Red Hook and Rhinebeck. Once in a while, I break down and go over there, but you got to worry about the
DOT.
Thank you. I hesitated to even say it, but the DOT sits right there on the other side of the bridge. And, you know, I'm all about keeping my equipment in good shape and having all my lights working, but somebody's light is already always not blinking. And
they'll find something.
They'll find something, right. So anyway.
State's got to make money.
They do. They find lots of ways to
they
do it.
They see it coming from a long ways away.
Yeah, they do. And I'm pretty liberal. I don't mind paying my dues, but enough is enough.
No, that's like a whole, man, you get into those heavy equipment and you got to keep a log in there. A lot of people don't realize the cost of maintaining equipment like that.
It's crazy. And when you have trailers, and we have trailers that haul things around, some wire is always loose on one of them. One tire is always getting bald. Anyway, we don't have to go on and on about that.
Yeah.
But it's a lot to worry about. So Rhinebeck and Red Hook, I tend not to go to once in a while.
Also, I don't know if this happens to you, but when I cross the Hudson River, mm-hmm. being someone from grew up on the west side, and I almost did it just now, my brain reverses east and west. Am I the only person that's happened? I've talked to one other person this happened to as well.
That's very interesting because I never put it quite as clearly as you just said, but yeah, I forget that I'm on the east side of the river, so when I go across to Rhinebeck, and that gets me backwards sometimes. That's interesting that you bring that up.
Just
I hadn't thought about that.
Just another reason not to cross the river.
Yeah, who needs to be more mixed up?
Right. Yep. So, but mostly it's, you know, in the central Ulster to southern or central Ulster, you would call it, to northeastern Ulster or something?
Right. And like that, an Olive Bridge, and we do a lot over in that neck of the woods. If it's a pleasant drive, I'll drive further. We go all the way out to the Beaver Kill area for Hemlock Trees out in that area.
Oh, wow.
That's an hour and a half one way. It's got to be, you know, worthwhile. But it's such a pleasant drive. I don't mind doing it. And I don't have to haul heavy equipment. You know?
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, how would you say, well, first of all, let me ask you this. You've been at this since, it says here, since 1986.
That's when I officially started. Yeah, as a business, yeah.
I mean, what changes have you seen in arboriculture? I mean, you know, it's a while ago in equipment, and what comes to mind, changes?
Well,
approach, perspective of trees, whatever,
yeah,
treatment.
The biggest thing that comes to mind is the advent or the occurrence of the invasive pests, the emerald ash borer and the hemlock woolly adelgid. They weren't around when I first got started, although the woolly adelgid just was maybe 4 or 5 years started showing up around my area after I got started. So those are the two things that really, really have changed the way I go about my daily business. Equipment, of course, is always getting better. They're making a lot better, more interesting lifts now, and chippers are bigger and more expensive. That's another thing. Equipment is getting crazy expensive.
Yeah.
That's just a hardcore reality of any tree dude's life.
Right.
And that's gotten a lot worse in the last decade. Another nice thing that's happening, though, in this area is people are becoming more and more aware of and caring about their trees as they live closer to home and start appreciating their own property. So I've found even more people that really care about their trees and want to know more about them, and that's encouraging, and I like that part of the business a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like if there's someone like you, they might, you know, it's kind of like a forester gets confused with a forest ranger.
Right.
An arborist can get confused with just a removal service.
That,
but you're more than a removal service,
right,
is what you're saying.
Totally more than a removal service. As a matter of fact, I talk people out of removing trees all the time.
Right.
Because their habitat, I like watching them fall apart slowly, as long as it's not over your house, over your driveway. I mean, there's times when you really do need to take out some trees, but I find them interesting even when they're dead, and it's great for habitat, birds and raccoons and even voles and mice and squirrels. Everybody out there likes a good tree to live in or hang out in, even if it's dead. So recently we've been doing more removals because we've got a new lift that is really great for doing removals, and so I'll do more now. But mostly the business has been about preserving trees and helping people preserve their cherished trees on their property and making them as healthy as we can and looking as good as we can. And I kind of equate health with appearance, and it's a little esoteric reasoning that I have there, but I often say if it looks better, it is better.
Well, I mean, yeah, art and science, right? I mean,
yes, they do overlap.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, I don't know how to ask this, but Can you give me some criteria for either a cherished tree, or the opposite of that would be criteria for a tree to be removed, I guess.
Right. Well, the cherished tree is a specimen, what I call a specimen of the species, something that's got perfect structure. It's out where it likes to be growing, and it provides a lot of shade. It provides beautiful fall color, maybe flowering in the spring or just a leaf emergence. Something that someone really identifies as a living thing. I really relate to trees as fellow living beings. If that sounds corny, I'm sorry. I am, as I like to say, a child of the 60s, and that still lingers. Maybe there isn't sentience or awareness in this tree, but there's organisms that are living in it that have some degree of sentience. So a cherished tree is a tree that the person who owns it or owns the property that it's on really relates to and gets a lot of four-season enjoyment out of. You know, a real danger tree is a tree that has bad structure, codominant leaders, big areas of decay, and it's leaning over your house. I mean, I've gotten a lot more into taking out trees that threaten people's homes with the ever-increasing frequency of the ever-increasingly intense storms that we're having.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you go through one Irene, which most of you around here I'm sure remember, and you see trees that were healthy trees. You know, they were solid, well-rooted trees, but just snapped in those 80-mile-an-hour winds, cleaving right down through the center of people's homes. All of a sudden, you start realizing, you know, maybe I don't want to go through that in the middle of winter my 70s, you know.
Right. Yeah, so, I don't blame you. Yeah. Especially white pine comes to mind.
Well, you know, and white pines, a lot of people badmouth white pines because they are a little more prone to breaking than other trees. They are a little more shallow-rooted. So if you get big, heavy winds, which was the case with Irene, it rained like crazy. The soil was saturated, and then the sun came out, and we thought it was over. But then the next day, the big winds came in, and that's when all the damage happened. And those wet soils didn't allow the pines to stand up so much, and they just fell. Also, black locusts, which I hardly ever see getting blown over in storms. Hmm. A lot of them went down in Irene also. So I love a good, solid white pine tree, but you don't want a big one leaning over your house.
I'm with you there. Away from the house, great tree. Awesome,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Near the house, man.
It's tough. I've had to suck it up and say, yeah, that tree should come out. It still hurts me because I identify as a tree. Individual trees, I love the individual tree for what it is, but you got to be realistic.
I mean, you have so much experience doing it, but I mean, what you're doing, right, is assessing risk, which is such an art and science.
It is an art and science, and I've had to ease into erring more on the side of the house and less on the side of the tree.
Right. Yeah.
When you're assessing the risks, especially because, as I say, in the crazy storms that we're getting more frequently and more intense, a tree that would be perfectly fine in a normal winter storm is much more a threat.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is Healthy Trees with Vern Rist.
White horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man was. White lace and feathers, they made up his bed. A gold covered mattress on which he was led. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
He went to fight wars for his country and his king, of his honor and his glory. The people would sing,
ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
A bullet had found him, his blood ran as he cried. No money could save him, so he lay down and he died.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is healthy trees with Vern Rist. And he has a business over in Saugerties, Ulster County. So, Vern,
yes.
Let's talk about your nemesis.
Yes. Hemlock woolly adelgid.
Which one you want to start with?
Well,
it's up to you.
They're of all the things that are going out in the woods, and there's always lots of things attacking trees, and the trees are always battling back. But the two big, let's say, epidemics around here now are the hemlock woolly adelgid and the emerald ash borer. The emerald ash borer is just kicking into its really intense stage around the Margaretville area now. It's been sneaking in around my house in Saugerties. You can't find an ash tree that's alive, very rarely, except for ones that have been treated over the years. Once in a while, I still find one. As a matter of fact, as a point of interest, there's a project called the Lingering Ash Project, and if you find an ash tree that's surrounded by dead ash trees everywhere that's still alive, this group wants to know about it to collect it as a source of, you know, potential breeding material or vegetative propagation to maybe preserve the species that way. But the emerald ash borer is as voracious of a killer of trees as anything that's ever been around. I mean, it's just as bad as the diseases, Dutch elm disease or chestnut blight. Even those were fungi, and this borer is an insect. But it's still a total ravaging of the species, or even the genus. In this case, with the ash, it's the genus. The good news is you can treat it if you do it early enough, and the materials are very effective. I know you do some.
How early do you think?
How early do you need to treat it?
Yeah.
If it's been infested is the right term, as opposed to infected. If it's been infested for more than 3 years, it's probably too late. If you get it before it's infested and there's other trees nearby, that's a great time. You know, when they're still nice and healthy and looking green, but other ones where it's just starting to show some symptoms, that's a great time to get on it. And then you can get a good 3 years out of that treatment before you need to consider doing it again.
What kind of symptoms stand out to you that's like, oh, man, this tree is no good?
Well, when you have more than, when you have 30 or 40% dieback from the top, that's not a good sign. And when you have, there's a symptom called blonding, which really isn't a symptom of the insect. It's once a tree gets fairly well infested with lots of larvae, the woodpeckers, especially the downy woodpecker, the hairy woodpecker, and probably the red-bellied woodpecker as well, they tune into that tree, and there's all these scrumptious little goodies in there that they can peck out, and they start flecking off the outer bark in the process of looking for the larvae, and that reveals the inner yellowish blonde color of the inner bark, and that you can see those patches, and that's called blonding. When you see a tree that's got a lot of blonding going on, it's probably a lost cause. If you've got just spots of that here and there, you can still save it.
You can still save it.
Yeah. And,
now you've been doing this a long time.
Well, we've been doing the emerald ash borer since it started, I think. Don't quote me on this, but around 2008, the first place it showed up in this part of the state was as the crow flies, as it would be my luck, 2 miles from my home. And so I've been doing
Ruby,
that.
Right? Is it Ruby?
It was right north of Ruby in Blue Mountain area at a campground. And one of the big ways that that man moves this pest around is in firewood. And it was not then... probably not coincidental that it was first found in a campground where someone had probably brought firewood and ash wood that was... So we've been doing that for 8 years. Switching to the hemlock woolly adelgid, that's been around this area for a good 20 years or more. And we've been dealing with that one as well. That one, as much as... it's not quite as instantly devastating as the emerald ash borer, and you do have time, especially since a lot of hemlocks grow up in the northern higher heights where the weather is a little more likely to slow down the spread of the insect, the so-called adelgid. It's still extremely devastating and has already done a lot of damage south of here, like in the Blue Mountains or in Connecticut. Grandstand of beautiful old hemlocks have already been devastated 15 years ago even. Again, there's effective treatments for that, and there's some hope with the introduction of predators or parasitoids of both the emerald ash borer and the hemlock woolly adelgid. And a lot of work's being done with them by the USDA and by Cornell and Mark Whitmore from Cornell, the forest entomologist there. He's a great guy, really dedicated to the Hemlock Initiative project that he founded. And so there's some hope in the future of bringing in these things, and that could be controversial as well, but I won't get into that right now. I'm introducing species that live strictly on the adelgid and hopefully can knock down the population once it gets established.
Yeah.
One tricky thing about that is one of the first requirements of a successful predator species is it has to be able to overwinter here. You know, if it doesn't do that, then it's a lost cause. So, anyway.
Is that the stumbling block with the, was it the silver-laced, whatever it is, for the hemlock woolly adelgid?
Well, with the hemlock woolly adelgid, there's a couple of different species of ladybug beetles.
Okay.
One's called Laricobius nigrinus, and that is showing some potential. And that, I think, has been shown to overwinter here. There was a lot of work put into a similar beetle 20 years ago out of Connecticut called Pseudoscimnus, and there was a lot of hope there. And it did eat a lot of adelgid, but it didn't really successfully get established through the winters. So you don't really know until you've tried, and you know it takes a lot of dedicated work by trained entomologists to not only know what to look for, but to know how to go about looking for it. But there's hope. It's similar with the emerald ash borer. There are four different species of parasitoid wasps that they have been getting some success with, and one or two species of Spathius, I believe, has been shown to 2 years down the down the road from releasing them, they have found natural populations still existing some distance from the release site. That's extremely positive. It doesn't instantly take care of the problem. It's hopefully down the road. Yes.
Is there any biocontrols like these that you're talking about that are offered privately yet or not yet?
Well, you can buy Laricobius nigrinus, for example, if you go online. It's going to be expensive. It used to be like $50 a beetle or something, or some crazy number like that.
Yeah.
And the chances are it's not going to work that well for you in your own backyard. You can always give it a shot.
Right.
But the beetles don't necessarily have to stay where they are released. You put them on a tree that's heavily loaded, well, it could help.
Hmm. So what about this elongate hemlock scale?
That's another thing that is extremely common on hemlocks. It's even more common than the adelgid, I think I'm able to say confidently. The good news about it is it's not quite as devastating as the hemlock woolly adelgid. It doesn't kill the buds so much, whereas the hemlock woolly adelgid will kill the buds. The scale makes the trees look like hell, though.
Mm.
And it's just unfortunate that way. And they can weaken the trees so that if you get a drought, they're that much more likely to go down. So it's another real common pest. The good news about that is it is a chemical insecticide, but it's very effective with very small amounts applied right to the tree, called dinotefuran. That's the active ingredient. That controls the scale as well as the adelgid. And typically the scale is a little bit harder to control than the adelgid is. So that's positive.
What about, how's it been this year? We talked off the air about the migration of woolly adelgid.
Right. This year, I'm sorry to say, I've seen more of the hemlock woolly adelgid around than I've seen in all the 20 plus years that I've been, very much tuned into it. As I said earlier in the show, hemlocks are my favorite trees.
Yeah.
And it really causes me, stress, sadness to see them getting damaged by this horrible invasive pest. And I tend to respect all species, but I have a limited tolerance for the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Right.
Anyway, so Mark Whitmore, again from Cornell, monitors these things very closely. He's almost his whole career right now is involved with hemlock woolly adelgid. And they monitor winter mortality of the insect, of the adelgid. And winters slow the insect down. They don't necessarily wipe it out. But the last 2 years, there was very low winter mortality of the adelgid. 2 years back, we talked about the warm temperatures. That was one of the reasons 2 years ago. This year, the temperature was colder, but it stayed consistently cold pretty much, and it wasn't fluctuating up and down a lot, which tends to be harder on the insect. So very low winter mortality 2 years in a row of the woolly adelgid resulted in just a real, you could say, an explosion of the presence of the adelgid this spring. And that was true up in Ithaca and everywhere that I've gone around here. And you were saying Delaware County, you've seen a lot
more
than ever. Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And people are calling me, people that would never have noticed the minor infestations before, but it was so obvious this year. When you get a tree that's heavily infested, it looks white from a distance.
High elevation areas that never used to get it before, above 2,000 feet, hemlock woolly adelgid.
Yeah, and that's really depressing.
Yeah.
The higher elevations, except for in some cases, tend to be a little colder, a little harsher, so it'll slow down. Along river stream beds that meander up into the mountains, that's, for whatever reason, you'll see a lot more woolly adelgid there. If you're driving from Tannersville down into Saugerties, and you go down through the Platte Clove area, if you're familiar with that, you can see along the stream that goes up there. It's a beautiful winding Catskill, Rip Van Winkle kind of stream. You can just see along the banks, even higher up than what you would expect, all the hemlocks that have been killed in the last decade.
Yeah, and in New Paltz area, Gardner, the Palmagot, that ravine was one of the first areas in Minnewaska to really get hammered in the 80s by the hemlock woolly adelgid.
Right. Yes, I have there was some grand hemlock trees at Mohonk.
Old growth.
Minnewaska, both.
Huge.
Yeah, just magnificent things. I'm thinking of Mohonk particularly. And it broke my heart to see him go. And I understand everyone's got to do what they got to do, but the owners of the property decided they were just going to let nature take its course, which I said, well, this is nature out of control. But yeah. And they didn't put any energy, as far as I know, into saving any of those, which I would have gladly donated my time to save some of those magnificent, you know, 250-year-old trees.
They're huge. Yeah, there's some in Upper Woodland Valley. And a member called and wanted us to treat, and I said, unfortunately, it's way too late. But yeah. They were huge hemlocks, man.
It's a sad thing.
Huge hemlocks.
Yeah, for our part of the world, hemlocks are sort of our redwoods in a certain way.
Yeah.
They can live for centuries. They used to live 500-600 years, now 300 years anyway. And they're a great, very interesting species. They can grow in the deep shade, which is one of the interesting things about hemlocks, or what's called a climax species. They can grow very slowly in the shade of taller trees. So a tree that's maybe 10 inches in diameter might be 100 years old in the shade. I've seen some that are 90 years old anyway. And then when something dies above them, or some wind blows down the pines that they're growing under and they get a shot of sun, all of a sudden they shoot up.
How do they do it? How do they photosynthesize in such darkness?
It is all about their photosynthetic capacity. And I know a little bit of the technicalities of photosynthesis, but I won't bore the listeners or also expose my limited knowledge on it. But it is all about their photosynthetic ability and how they can harvest the light they need in very shady situations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if solar panels were as efficient as a hemlock, I don't know.
That would be great. Maybe we're on to something if we could figure it out.
Yeah, right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Healthy Trees with Vern Rist.
Ideas ain't nothing but a fool to live like this. Out all night and running wild, woman sitting home with a month old child. Dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? Sitting around drinking with the rest of the guys. Six rounds bought and I bought five. Spent the groceries and half the rent, like $14.27. So dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? One more. They say a rose is red and violet's purple, and sugar's sweet and so is maple syrup. And I'm the seventh out of seven sons. My pappy was a pistol, I'm a son of a gun. I said, dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me?
All right, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is healthy trees with Vern Rist. So, Vern, what are some common things you constantly get asked?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, what comes to mind right now is I get phone...
Is it a good question?
Well, other than the fact that I have to explain it one more time, it's a good question because it's relevant and it's people on people's minds.
Yeah.
I mean, right now I'm getting a lot of phone calls about especially sugar maples, but it's also on oaks and hickories. The trees are, the leaves are brown and falling off early. Also, apple trees, crab apple trees, early defoliation. and it's particularly pronounced this year. And it's that results from various leaf fungi, leaf spot diseases, we call it very generally, or a lot of them are what we call anthracnoses, which is the case with the sugar maple. And they are diseases that love, the spores love to have a wet leaf surface to get started. You know, they're like microscopic seeds that start these leaf spots that then grow together, coalesce, cause the leaves to be totally brown out and abscise or fall off prematurely. And that's what's going on big time right now with bare apple trees, sugar maples, a lot, and other trees as well. The trees aren't dead. They tolerate it very well. And don't worry so much if you think you're defoliated tree is dead. It isn't. It's actually probably got a lot of good healthy buds. If you look closely at the buds that, along the twigs, you'll see that they're nice and plump still, because it was actually a good growing season. So a lot of photosynthesis was going on, and all the rain was actually, other than that it promotes some of these diseases, it's also very good for the trees, because they get a lot of transpiration going on and a lot of good nutrients being brought up from the soil. So that's one very common problem, is the leaf spot diseases, especially this year.
Do you ever remember this with sugar maple being this much anthracnose?
This is the most I've seen it in a number of years. And again, because of all the rain that favors, it's what's called a compound interest disease. It gets started with one little spot way back in the spring, but that spot produces a lot more spores of the fungus, and it keeps repeating itself. Mm. Some diseases are simple interest disease. The initial thing is all you get. But with these leaf spot diseases, so it's favored by the wet conditions that promote the spore production and the spore germination. So this is about as severe as I've seen with the sugar maples, but I have seen it bad before in other years. And I promise you, the trees aren't dead, and they can tolerate it much better than you can technically.
So I shouldn't recommend removal?
Please don't do that. I know you wouldn't.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, but there are some folks, and I don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but people might say, oh, you got to take that tree out. Well, think twice, you don't.
Yeah. So what other questions?
I get a lot of questions about pileated woodpecker holes and white pines. That's another one that I get tired of explaining. That's a big hole at the pileated woodpecker. Whenever you see that happening, it's very common in white pines, but also maples and any tree. Those woodpeckers are always going in there. And the pileated woodpeckers are the woody woodpecker that you see out there. A beautiful, beautiful bird. Really, really raucous call. And he chips out big chips. I mean, it's amazing he can do that. Anyway, when he's making those holes, he's looking for carpenter ants that are inside the center of the tree. That's one of his main foods. And the carpenter ants also get a bad rap. They're not killing the tree. They're living in the dead wood in the center of the tree that's already dead. They're finishing off the tree and not even damaging it so much, because they're only living in what's already dead.
Right.
And they're going outside of the tree to eat. They're just colonizing and living inside the protection of the tree.
So you shouldn't shoot the woodpecker is what you're saying.
I would say.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying don't shoot the woodpecker.
All right.
Yeah. And the holes that they're making, they weaken the tree a little, but not so much as you think. Hmm. And so you can try to discourage the woodpeckers by putting hardware cloth loosely around the tree. And that sometimes makes them go away, or at least makes them go up higher in the tree where they do less damage. And so that's another really common thing I get a lot of calls about.
At what point is the woodpecker damage cause of concern, I guess?
When you get multiple holes going up several sides of the tree, you know that woodpecker, or him and his family, are really cashing in on the carpenter ants, and so that there is extensive dead wood in the center that neither of those creatures are causing, but they're revealing. That's when if you've got five or six holes and three different lines going up the tree, that's maybe you're getting into a tree that you might want to consider taking down, especially if it's over your house.
Your targets and property and whatnot.
Yeah, or your parking area or your kids' playground.
Right. More permanent kind of things going on there.
Yeah.
What are things, we only got two and a half minutes
which
here.
Which is too bad.
What are some things you wish people knew about trees?
Well, That's a big question.
I know. It's just 2 minutes.
I wish they knew that they didn't have to take. This is a biggie for me. That you don't have to take down trees that someone might suggest you have to take it down for whatever reason. You should always get an arborist who cares about keeping up the trees and who doesn't just make a living by removing trees. I wish people were more aware of what a hazard tree is and what a hazard tree isn't. That's one thing I wish they knew about. Also, just the basic biology of the tree is a fascinating thing that you don't really get to understand without some academic training unless you're really into reading. But it's a fascinating thing that I like to share with people. For one thing, just as a tiny little example, water has to travel from the ground through the tiny little feeder roots all the way up that tree, that 100-foot tree. Every cell in those leaves up above, which are billions, needs water with the nutrients from the soil to get to it. Water is heavy.
Yeah.
How does that water get up that tree? It's a question that there's all sorts of theories and formulations and bits and pieces assembled about how it does that. But it still doesn't explain. We still don't know 100% sure.
I can tell you the term, but I don't know how it works. Like capillary action, but I don't know how that works exactly.
Capillary action only represents a small fraction of the energy required to get the tree up, to get it up there.
I don't know how a microwave works either. So.
Well, right. But it's a fascinating thing, and I don't necessarily expect everyone to know about it. But it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
And it's a neat thing to think about when you look at that tree and what it needs to do. And it pumps on a good day when there's lots of moisture in the soil. It might transpire, which is a process of losing the water through the leaves from the roots all the way up through the xylem and out through the leaves, called transpiration. They might transpire 100 gallons a day.
When I think of sap, I think of maple sugar, and some of these trees are ridiculous how much sap comes out during that late winter, early spring.
It still boggles my mind, and I'm thinking, where's all that coming from?
Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have on From the Forest. And, Vern, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I wish it was longer.
Yeah, me too. And have a good night. See you next week.
And the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd end up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. Flowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river